broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Climate change has already made the United States poorer, Arizona economics professor Derek Lemoyne reports. How could carbon from our tailpipes make the sea acidic? Really? How does that work? Tulane chemist Bruce Gibb explains with a great 15-minute mini-lecture on Radio EcoShock. Welcome, I'm Alex Smith. Most of us are under a money siege. Everything costs more. The scam economy is flourishing. Billionaires feast. Isn't it a stretch to blame any of that on climate change? Let's ask an expert. Climate change has already made the United States poorer. That study was published November 7, 2025, in the prestigious journal PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The findings come from Dr. Derek Lemoyne. Derek is professor of economics at the University of Arizona and co-director of the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. From Tucson, Derek Lemoyne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Affordability, it's a hot political issue these days, and some of our listeners may be feeling poorer, but isn't it a stretch to blame any of that on climate change?
I can't attribute any given listener's situation to climate change. We can just look at aggregate data around the country. We can relate income. We have data on income at the county level. We have data on weather at the county level. We can relate these two things. And when you relate them, there is a connection. Years of hotter days in a given county typically tend to have lower income. I can't say exactly why that is or what's the channel, but with one caveat I can get to. But you know, the relationship is there statistically in the data.
Well, lots of reports predict future economic penalty, you know, by the year 2100 or something for more greenhouse gases. What stimulated you to figure out costs that are already happening?
Yeah, so by and large, I've been somewhat skeptical of our ability to produce numbers about impacts in 2100 or at any future date. And even though those numbers are pretty critical to figuring out what policy should be, I mean, the whole idea is that we're producing emissions that affect the economy way out into the future, and we need to know what those effects are to understand whether and how much to control emissions. And I've been skeptical about our ability to really know that number. But then thinking about it, it's like, well, if we can't say what climate change is already doing. I mean, that seems like an easier question because we are, at least we're in the current economy we want to evaluate, and at least we already have the data that we need to do that. So let's at least take that first step, the thing that we'd have to be able to do the bigger picture question, and just see how well we can do that. And then, you know, and that maybe that will inform the other enterprise. But I wanted to know whether it could be done, and then on top of that, just, you know, the question itself that has merit, because you can then take that answer and think about where should you invest in adapting to climate change, how should you report this as a regular economic indicator, maybe on the par with others that we regularly produce. So if I can come up with a methodology, this could be a number that we could then look to regularly.
Are you finding increased costs due to more billion-dollar weather disasters hitting the United States, or is this more a loss from steady shift in daily temperatures?
That's a great question. It's completely the latter. I'm not looking at anything about extreme events. This is really just day-to-day temperatures shifting all around the country.
But there's so many factors going on. We're in a rapidly changing business environment. How did you sort out climate costs in this study?
Yes, that's part of the key. And in a way, I think that's why it's easier to do this study than to project way in the future. When, I mean, imagine we're 1900 projecting for today. We have no idea what the economy would look like or how it'd be affected by weather. But we have years of data on weather and on income. Again, we can see how these things are related in the data. We have climate models that are very good at, you know, replicating historical climate, and they can tell us what the climate would have been without a human contribution, and we could see what it actually was in the data. The difference between those says how many more of the hotter days and how many of the changes in warm and cold days are due to climate change. And so then I have a theoretical framework that brings these things together where I can then say, okay, climate models say the weather changed this much because of humans. The data say that changes in weather tend to have this effect on income, and this is the total effect. The key thing, though, is that what you don't want to do, and what I'd say most prior work on related topics has done, is that you don't want to just look at the effect of changing temperatures today or this year in this particular location. The whole deal with climate change is it changes temperatures in a more persistent fashion, and it changes them everywhere all at once. And so the real novelty of the framework was trying to incorporate that persistence and the widespread nature of climate change and do something quantitative with that. And I find that's really critical. If you ignore that, you find very small effects of climate change from just changing the weather where I am now. But once you account for how weather everywhere changes and changes in a persistent way, then those effects start accumulating, suggesting that trade is an important channel.
Economists and business people talk about the value of capital. We call our system capitalism. Should banks and investing institutions include something like climate depreciation in their reports and plans?
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on whether they should break out climate depreciation, but certainly they need to be thinking about all sorts of risks. Climate change is clearly a risk to many kinds of investments, and to the extent that's a risk for their investments and to the extent it depreciates capital faster, it should be in those numbers. Whether it needs to be broken out, I don't know, but certainly the risk of climate impacts and the risk of policy, which could also affect their quality and value of their investments, is something that should be incorporated like any other risk.
Everybody's concerned with rising prices. Is climate change part of inflation, and how could you know that?
Right. So that's a good question. So what seems to be happening, I believe the reason why I'm finding that climate change around the country matters for income in a given location is I can show that basically it appears the channel is to trade, as I mentioned, trade within the country, not between this country and other countries. That suggests that it actually is a price channel. And so like one example could be, and this is consistent with the findings in the paper, that you might imagine that extreme heat hurts you if you're a corn farmer in Iowa. It's going to make your productivity lower, and that's bad for your income. But if you're the only one who gets hit, then that's really not a good thing for you. But if all the other corn farmers also get hit, then there's less corn on the market, and prices go up, and you could actually be better off, even though you have lower productivity. And the data are consistent with those kinds of patterns, where if you're the only one who gets hit, then you have a hit, then you're hurt. But if other producers also get hit, then you're helped. But consumers everywhere else are hurt because prices went up. And so it does seem like there's a price channel. I'm not going anywhere near in this paper trying to decompose recent inflation into climate change or not. And I think there are plenty of other reasons for recent inflation. But I do think that there is a price effect of climate change.
You built your formula, as you say, from very specific data, drilling right down to daily temperature records over decades, and you did it all at the county level. Why that detail?
It's important to go to the county level. You need daily temperature in order to capture extremes. If you look at monthly averages, then the average temperature in a month might not reflect the hottest days in the month. And so we think that these extreme days actually might matter, and that's consistent with what I found, that like the extreme heat and cold do matter differently than like moderate heat, moderate cold. And then at the county level, that's really got advantages because when you do things at states, they're just statistically, it just doesn't work as well. There's just what we would call fewer observations. So getting down to the county level, you're getting down to a more granular economy where you can start to think about, you can just do tests that you can't do at the state level. Like the linkages are just a little bit different and a little closer to where people actually live and work. And you also know what the weather is better. At the state level, a lot of states have a lot of different kind of weather inside of the state. At the county level, counties are a lot more homogeneous. You kind of know you can better calculate what the weather would be that's actually affecting people.
The U.S. company First Street estimates a potential loss of real estate values of almost $1.5 trillion in just the next 30 years due to climate-related risks. Did you include property values in your study?
No, not unless it's directly related to changes in income in a location. And the kinds of risks that they're talking about are likely to be risks due to things like extreme storms and sea level rise that were not the kinds of risks I was studying in this paper. So that's probably a number that's got some relation, but is not closely related to what I was doing here.
There's another twist in calculating weather costs. Americans are famous for moving around. Do population shifts affect the overall economic figures for climate costs?
That's a great question, and that's an example of what economists call adaptation. To the extent that people are moving in response to climate change or in response to weather, that will be one way of adapting to climate change. Where that comes in, because I'm not projecting in the future, so I'm taking whatever the current population is, I'm taking that for granted. The main assumption I have to make there is that without climate change, people would have been living in the same place as they are now. That's obviously not perfect, but it's better. It's a better fit to the recent economy than it would be to the next 100 years, because there's only been so much climate change to date. It's relatively new that like people are seeing it and experiencing it. Whereas in 100 years, I mean, everybody's going to have sorted based on everybody will have had plenty of opportunity to have sorted based on weather and based on knowledge of climate change. So I do have to assume that population is people basically live where they would have lived anyway without climate change. And the economy basically looks like what it would have looked like otherwise. We would have still had the internet. We would have still had the similar technologies that we have now. But, you know, it's just that we have a different distribution of weather.
When we think about the frontline economic casualties of climate change, we tend to think of Californians and their fires and Florida's displaced by hurricanes. But you found the biggest losers in this race in a surprising part of the country. Tell us about that.
Right. Once you start accounting for the effects of trade, the losses become very widely distributed. So when you think about if we were to reduce climate change to just these shifts in weather where I live and nowhere else changed, only where I live, then you do get different places that are benefiting and losing. But once you account for the fact that all the counties in the U.S. are linked and that weather in other counties is also going to affect income in my county, that's when you get bigger losses that are noisy. They're uncertain, but they are bigger. And you also get the losses being much more widespread. So there's a small pocket of the country in the far north that looks like it's benefiting, but the vast majority of the country is losing once you account for the widespread nature of climate change.
So what are the figures you came up with after your calculations?
So the central estimate is that climate change is already reducing income by around 12%. That's a number that's on the order. When you think about big ticket policy proposals, like a big ticket reform to immigration or a big ticket reform to maybe tax law or something like that, but like not like a small change, but like a large change, those kinds of changes have impacts in the same order of magnitude. So climate change is looking like something like a big policy reform. It's an uncertain number. I mean, the confidence interval stretches from like 2% to, you know, upwards of 20%. But that central estimate in my main specification is around that 12% mark. And in almost any way I do the data, it's somewhere in the like 7 to 12 type region.
What is that 12%? Is that a loss of GDP or what?
The 12% reduction in income per capita today due to climate change.
Oh, so that's individuals losing about 12% of their spending power, let's say, just because of climate change.
Correct. That's what it seems to be in the data.
That's a big hit already.
For spending power, I should also know what happens to prices. So this is only the income side. So if prices also went down, then that spending power would be affected. But if you held, which I don't think you should hold prices fixed, but if you did, and I can't really say how they changed, then yeah, it would be a big hit to spending power.
The economist Adrian Bilal at Harvard says the potential losses from a 2-degree C rise over pre-industrial levels would be an economy basically like the 1929 Great Depression, but forever. Now, given what you've seen so far, Derek, do you find those kind of dark scenes credible?
That study takes a very different approach. What they're doing is they're taking, I believe, national level data on GDP, and they're relating different economies' GDP to just the level of global temperature. They need to make a few more assumptions and then they're projecting going forward in the way that I'm avoiding doing in this paper. There's some statistical advantages to you. You asked why I use counties. Counties allow me to sort of take care of anything that's so in a given year, income all around the U.S. tends to be higher or lower because the world economy is doing better or worse, or because there's a new technology, or because of policies in the U.S., or whatever else might be going on. And some of those changes might just happen to correlate with changes in temperature. So by using a bunch of different counties, I can look at the changes in county-level income that are different from what happened to all counties in common, and the changes in county-level weather that are different than happened to everybody in common, which allows me to be sure that I'm picking up the effect of weather and not the effect of new technology X or global trade policy Y that just happened to correlate with temperature. they can't use that same approach in their studies. So there is always some uncertainty about whether they're really picking up the effect of temperature. And they are also attributing their effects to extreme events that are driven by global temperature rather than to these sort of trade channels that I'm talking about in my paper.
Surely business must be seeing these climate costs coming into their books. You work with something called the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. The consortium brings together electric utilities and policymakers and academics, and what we're trying to do is think about big picture questions that are coming down the pipe for the energy industry. So there, climate change is posing physical risks that need to be dealt with. In particular, we're doing a lot of work on wildfire risk right now. And so then there are questions about what should investments today be and what should the policy infrastructure be to facilitate those investments in order to mitigate these risks that are, you know, in some places already more real, but are only going to be amplified and growing as time goes on. So what can we do today to prepare for coming climate risks?
From the University of Arizona in Tucson, we've been getting the economic impact of climate for Americans from Dr. Derek Lemoine. His November 2025 paper is Climate Change Has Already Made the United States Poorer. Find links to follow up in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. Derek, thank you for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Acid ocean? How? Pardon me, I'm stuck on how a gas becomes rock and changes survival in the whole ocean. There is some kind of mass magic here, well hidden from human understanding. Last week on Radio EcoShock, two scientists warned ocean acidification has already passed the planetary boundary for safety. Check the show website at ecoshock.org for those interviews with top scientists Richard Neely and Helen Findley. But frankly, I still don't get it. I want a physical scientist to explain ocean acidification to me like I'm an 8-year-old. Luckily, a Louisiana chemist just wrote an approachable article about all that in the journal Nature Chemistry. I called him up. And here is our conversation, including a 15-minute mini-lecture for the public on the actual process of ocean acidification. Carbon is really the magic Houdini of elements. It can be a rock, part of living things, a gas in the air, and many chemicals in the sea. I wish it was easy to understand exactly what happens to our carbon emissions when they get into the ocean. How does a chemist see it? Dr. Bruce Gibb is an expert in aqueous supramolecular chemistry at Tulane University in Louisiana. Bruce wrote an essay on ocean acidification, published November 3, 2025, in Nature Chemistry. The enigmatic title is Extinguishing the Saturation Horizon. It describes little-known costs to changing carbon levels in the environment. From New Orleans, Bruce Gibb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Scientists tell us about a third of human-made carbon emissions are captured by the sea. Without that, we would likely have overheated long before now. Are there limits to how much carbon dioxide the ocean can absorb?
Yes, and maybe not. So that's a rather complicated question. It sounds fairly straightforward. But there are both the total amount of carbon dioxide that we need to think that can be absorbed by the ocean. And then there's the rate by which the carbon dioxide is being absorbed. And so we have to factor both of these things into thinking about the problem of ocean acidification. So in theory, given enough time, yes, the oceans could absorb all the CO2 in the atmosphere that we're pumping out through global warming. Pumping out through burning of hydrocarbons and petroleum products. But it's the rate by which we are generating the CO2 that is the problem, because the ocean, although it's very good in the long term at absorbing the CO2, does so very slowly, much more slowly than we pump it out. And so that's the problem, is that there's a catch-up, there's a delay time. And in the meantime, the oceans are becoming slightly more acidic than they are naturally. because of this lag time in absorbing and using up the carbon dioxide that is dissolved.
Before we dig deeper into that, I'm sure a couple of listeners are wondering, what is aqueous supramolecular chemistry?
So supramolecular chemistry deals with the interaction of molecules, how one molecule interacts with another. It's something that happens all over the universe. It's happening inside us with proteins and medicines we take, for example. The aqueous part is, of course, just referring to water. So when you have two molecules that interact, they interact with each other in a different way depending on their environment. So if you're in an organic solvent, you might get one type of interaction. If you're in the gas phase, you might get another. And water tends to be quite different, a sort of third place, a third universe by which molecules interact. And so we're just really focused on molecules, how they interact and what we can do with that, but working within water.
Could you describe the process that makes the ocean more acidic as the atmosphere builds up more carbon dioxide?
Okay, so to do that, it's probably best to take a step back or two. And what we need to be thinking about, the big picture take-homes that we want to store in our brains, are two topics. One is the inorganic carbon cycle, and the second is the nature of acidity, what is an acid. So let's start with the first of these, the inorganic carbon cycle. As you mentioned in your introduction, the element carbon is utilized or used and found in all sorts of places, in the atmosphere, in us, in rocks. And the inorganic carbon cycle is part of the overall carbon cycle of the planet, which deals with what life isn't. So the rocks, the atmosphere, these are dynamic processes or involve dynamic processes, but it's all inanimate. And so when we think about the inorganic carbon cycle, if we start off with, say, the rock reservoir that is the bulk of our planet, the crust is composed in large amounts of calcium carbonate and carbonate silicate-based minerals. And in fact, if you add up all the carbon on Earth, including the life forms in every way, shape, and form that we see in the world, 99% or more of the carbon is actually in the rocks. So these are an important part, the important part of the inorganic carbon cycle. Now on the seafloor, at the subduction zones where the tectonic plates meet, these minerals are taken down and buried deep within the mantle. And under high temperature and high pressure conditions that you find there, carbonate sediments from the ocean and silicates are combined to form a variety of minerals that ultimately react and generate carbon dioxide. So that carbon dioxide leaks out of the Earth. It leaks out through volcanism, through volcanoes, through thermal vents on the seabed, soda springs. That carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. As I said, carbon dioxide. So we've got carbon in the rocks. We've got them reacting under the high pressure and temperature, releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. What happens there? In the atmosphere, the CO2 combines with water in the atmosphere. And so when it rains, it's not raining pure water, but it's raining water with some carbon dioxide dissolved in it. That solution of carbon dioxide is ever so slightly acidic, and we'll come to acidity in just a minute, but it's slightly reactive, and it causes the minerals on land to slowly dissolve. And so there's weathering, very long-term, slow process, but, you know, you're probably familiar, of course, with carbonate minerals and chalk and all the caves that can form by the dissolution of these carbonate minerals into the water, into the pool cooled on the surface from rainfall. Those carbonate minerals themselves end up in the ocean, obviously through rivers, and ultimately are pooled with all the other resources of carbonate materials on the ocean floor, and so the cycle continues. So we have this inorganic carbon cycle that basically involves rocks being heated, giving off CO2, CO2 going into the atmosphere, CO2 getting pulled out of the atmosphere by rain, washing and reacting with rocks and moving the carbonate back in. And so this cycle continues. And that cycle is a very, very slow process, obviously. It takes a long time to form a cave. It takes a long time for plates to move in plate tectonic processes. We're talking geological timescales. So that's one part we need to be familiar with. Now, of course, as life, we have utilized this carbon, this inorganic carbon cycle, not only for building ourselves. You know, you can think of bone is in large part composed of these carbonate minerals. You can think of teeth. We ourselves have utilized calcium carbonate as blackboard chalk. We also use it to form lime, which is another calcium mineral, which is used in cements and plasters. And, of course, all the life, or much of the life in the ocean, if not all of it, has utilized some of these carbonate salts heavily. And so you have crustaceans, which have shells that are composed of these carbonate minerals in large part. And phytoplankton as well have shells that are composed of calcium carbonate. So life utilizes this carbon, this inorganic carbon cycle, in all sorts of ways, both for growth and development, but also just for utilization in hand. So why is all that tied to acidity? So we've got to take another step back and talk about acidity and what is acidity. So acidity in the most general terms is, let's take another step back. Let's go to the element hydrogen, the most abundant element in the universe. Most molecules and chemicals contain some form of hydrogen, and so we can think of water, H2O, so that's one oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms. And hydrogen ions, which are positively charged species, or protons, are a hydrogen atom that's lost its electron, and these are commonly shared between different kinds of molecules. So one water molecule can, for example, donate a hydrogen ion to another water molecule, or vice versa. We can, in very general terms, trifurcate the universe into molecules that love to donate these protons or hydrogen ions, and these are called acids. Those that love to receive them, and these are called bases. And those that don't really care one way or other, and we generally just call those neutral molecules. And so we have acids that like to give protons, bases that like to accept them, and neutrals that don't care one way or the other. So different acids and different bases donate or accept a proton or hydrogen ion to different degrees. Not all molecules behave the same way. And so we have a continuum, just to focus on acidity, we have a continuum from strongly acidic to weakly acidic. And to be able to define that, we have to utilize some sort of scale, some sort of metric or measure, and that is the pH scale. And so if you Google pH scale, you'll find some beautiful colored images ranging from highly acidic to highly basic. And there's many common foodstuffs and items that we can find at home that fit within this pH scale. So the strongest acid you might come across on a day-to-day basis is something like lemon juice. Here we go, lemon juice. That has a pH of value of 3. Now, acids can have pH values of 0, which are much stronger. It is slightly counterintuitive, but the stronger the acid, the lower the number. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what you might come across, a strong acid might be an example of lemon juice. If you've ever squirted lemon juice in your eye, you know that hurts a bit because that acid does react and does interact with the surface molecules in your eye, and so that stings. Tomatoes are less acidic, so they have a pH of about 5, maybe. Water is fairly neutral. It has a pH of, or pure water is neutral, has a pH